questions from the young stranger. In a matter of 30 seconds, they were set up in ambush. A few minutes more saw Murdoch come running into the shop, frantically looking for the bay. When he saw Buck at the back of the forge, he went directly to him, too desperate to question the disappearance of the three men who had been there. He and his partner's half-cocked plan to take the strongbox while the horses were being changed had come apart when the warning shots were fired. Murdoch had been flat on his back when he heard the three shots, having just been thrown from the horse he had stolen. When he looked toward the stagecoach, he saw four men on top of Curly, so there was nothing for him to do but run. In his panic to escape the angry ranch hands and the stagecoach guard, he didn't notice a different saddle on the bay. He was within 6 feet of the horse when Pearlie, Bowman, and Baskin all popped up from their hiding places with three weapons aimed at him. At that point, Bowman took charge of the arrest. "Throw up your hands or we'll shoot you down," he commanded. Murdoch hesitated, raising his hands less than shoulder high beside him. He looked from face to face, studying the three men he had buffaloed so easily just minutes before. He couldn't see a killer's face on any of the three. "All right," he said, calm now after he had weighed his chances. "Here's what we're gonna do. I'm gonna step up on that crazy horse and ride out of here, and nobody gets shot." "That horse is gonna throw you again," Burley said confidently. "If he does, I'll put a bullet in his head," Murdoch replied, getting edgy again, when sounds of men coming toward them reached his ears. "You're not going anywhere," Bowman said. "You're under arrest for trying to hold up the stage." "And horse stealing," Pearlie added. Murdoch glanced again at the men confronting him. He decided he liked his odds, so he turned and faced Bowman. "The hell I am," he swore, and went for his gun, only to drop it a split second later when a bullet from Pearlie's .44 smashed his wrist and he let out a yowl of pain. Bowman stood there, frozen by the threat upon his life. Pearlie walked over from the water barrel he had taken cover behind and relieved Murdoch of his other pistol. "Now we'll walk on back to the street. Maybe do something to fix that wrist," he said. "I don't know if there's a doctor here or not, but maybe you ought to wrap your bandana around it to slow that bleeding down."
"That was a hell of a shot," Baskin said,
finding his voice again after a short period.
"I might have shot too, but in my hurry to get my rifle, I forgot the cartridges. If you had a missed, I might have hit him in the head with it, though."
He nodded slowly.
"That was one hell of a shot," he repeated, and shook his head, still thinking about it. "Course you might have been aiming at his chest, I reckon."
"Might have been," Pearlie said. He saw no need to explain that when he saw Murdoch draw his pistol, he visualized Murdoch's moving hand, much as he had the striking rattlesnake back in Paris, and it was the hand he was trying to kill. They were met in the lane that served as a street by a sizable gathering of people, including most of the stage passengers who had gone inside the hotel dining room. Willis Adams, the ranch foreman, took their prisoner into custody and had a couple of his men march him and his partner to a smokehouse for safekeeping until the cavalry patrol returned from Rawhide Buttes.
"That was about the dumbest attempt to hold up a stage that I've ever heard of," Adams remarked, after Murdoch and Curly were locked in the smokehouse. "Right in the middle of the station, where any number of men could have shot him, instead of out along the road somewhere. Who shot that one in the wrist?"
"This young man right here," John Bowman spoke up. "Pearlie Gates is his name, and he saved my life, because that fellow, that Murdoch fellow, was fixing to shoot me."
"Well, good work, Pearlie," Adams said, and stepped up to shake his hand. "I haven't seen you around here before. You passing through? Ain't by any chance looking for a job, are you?"
Pearlie said that he wasn't, then went on to explain why he was on his way to Deadwood.
"Well," Adams continued,
I expect Bill Daly and Slim Cotton will want to thank you for your help. They're the driver and guard for the stage company." Burley shook hands with each of them, and Adam said, "After you find your grandpa, if you need work, I can always use a man like you." "Thank you, sir," Burley said. "But I expect I'll go back to Texas." "Well, I'll tell you where you're going to eat supper tonight," Bowman said. "At the hotel, with my wife and daughter and myself." "I wouldn't want to cause any extra bother for your wife, Mr. Bowman. I've got plenty of supplies to cook my supper." "Nonsense," Bowman insisted. "She'd be mad at me if I didn't invite you to supper. If you don't accept my invitation, I'll have Willis here lock you up with those two for insulting my wife." Burley grinned. "In that case, I reckon I'll accept the invitation, but I need to take care of my horses." "You can leave them in the stable," Adams offered. "We'll give them water and oats, and you can pick them up in the morning whenever you're ready to leave." "Much obliged," Burley said. "You mind if I sleep in the stable with them?" "Better than that," Bowman said before Adams could reply. "You'll be staying in the hotel tonight as my guest." A spectator to the conversation to that point, Ralph Baskin, spoke up. "And I'll shoe your pack horse first thing in the morning. No charge." "Well, you can't beat that," Burley said, overwhelmed by the outpouring of generosity on everybody's part. "I'm much obliged to all of you, but I'm able to pay my share." "No such thing," Bowman replied. "I'm sure you can, but you hadn't planned to. So just accept our gratitude for helping us out. Now you go on and take your horses to the stable, and bring your saddlebags and whatever you need to stay overnight. Then come on back to the hotel, and I'll fix you up with a room for the night. After that, we'll go to supper." "I appreciate it," Burley said, and walked back to the blacksmith shop with Baskin to get his horses. Behind them, Bowman and Adams watched them walk away. "It's too bad that young man isn't looking for a job," Bowman remarked. "You could definitely use a man like him. He knows horses. I saw a demonstration of that when he calmed that ornery horse Murdoch was riding. Probably knows cattle, too, since he said home was a cattle ranch in Texas. But more than that, he's the best I've ever seen with a gun, and when it counts. I swear, Willis, I thought I was a dead man. That son of a bitch drew on me, had his gun already out, and Purley shot it out of his hand before he could pull the trigger. No, sir, there's a lot more to Purley Gates than meets the eye. He just happens to have that innocent look about him." Adams shrugged. "You heard me offer him a job, but he didn't seem to be interested in it. He might have a wife and young'uns back in Texas. Did you ask him?" Bowman shook his head, so Adams shrugged again. "Why don't you and Lucille and Martha work on him tonight? Maybe you can convince him there's opportunities for young men out here." They stood there a few minutes longer, until Purley and Baskin disappeared around the corner of the forge. "Well," Adams concluded, "I've got to get back to work before my men think it's a holiday." He started toward the barn, then stopped and turned around. "Purley Gates. That's a hell of a name, ain't it? Wonder how many barroom fights that started." He turned back again, not waiting for Bowman's answer. Purley couldn't help feeling a bit guilty when he showed up at the hotel a little while later, carrying his rifle and saddlebags. There was no one at the small desk in the foyer, but he saw a bell on the desk, so he rang it a couple of times. A gray-haired man came from the hallway and, upon seeing him, asked, "Are you Mr. Gates?" Purley confessed that he was, and the man said, "Welcome. Mr. Bowman said to show you to your room, if you'll just follow me." He turned and led Purley back down the hall. Stopping at the last door before another one leading outside, he said, "This room is close to the washroom, if you're wanting to clean up, just outside that door and about 5 yards away. If the door is open, feel free to use it. Mr. Bowman said he'd meet you in the dining room at 6 o'clock." "Much obliged," Purley said, already enjoying the regal treatment he was receiving, something he was not at all accustomed to. It was after 5 o'clock, confirmed by his railroad pocket watch, but there was still time to take advantage of the washroom, so he got his clean shirt, underwear, and socks out of his saddlebags, as well as his shaving mug and razor, and went at once to the washroom. He had not planned to change into clean clothes for another couple of days, but considering the occasion, he felt it was called for. The door to the washroom was open, with a sign on it that read, "In Use," so he went inside and closed it behind him. After a good scrubbing, he toweled off and emptied his bathwater into a large square hole in the floor beside the tub that seemed to be a good place to get rid of it. Then he pumped a bucket of water and placed it on the small iron stove where he had found it, assuming that the next bather would fill the tub from the pump, then warm the water with that on the stove, just as he had. Clean-shaven and freshly scrubbed, he felt ready to dine with Bowman and his wife. The dining room was a cozy room with a stone fireplace at one end, not surprising to Pearlie, since it was a small hotel. There was a long table in the center, which occupied a large portion of the room, with two smaller tables with 4 chairs each close to the fireplace. There were only 3 people at the long table, since most of the diners had been there at 5 when the dining room opened for supper. Seated at one of the small tables, he saw John Bowman and 2 women. Upon spotting Pearlie, Bowman waved to signal him. Remembering his hat then, Pearlie removed it and proceeded to join them. "Pearlie," Bowman began, "we're glad to have you join us. This is my wife, Lucille, and my daughter, Martha." "Ma'am?" "Ma'am," Pearlie responded, nodding to each of the women in turn before he pulled the chair out and sat down. "Ladies," Bowman announced, "this is Mr. Pearlie Gates." Pearlie detected the faint trace of a grin on the young lady's face, although she struggled to hide it. Lucille Bowman, however, maintained a passive reception to his name. "We're so glad you could join us, Mr. Gates. My husband tells me we owe you our thanks for saving his life." Pearlie flushed a soft shade of crimson. "Why, no, ma'am," he stuttered. "I just helped your husband and Mr. Baskin a little bit." "You're too modest, Mr. Gates," she replied. "John told us all about it." He was saved from having to reply when a woman came in from the kitchen, carrying a tray with 4 serving bowls on it, and placed them on the table. Pearlie realized then that Mrs. Bowman had not cooked supper for him, as he had first assumed. He felt stupid for not having guessed that Bowman was the owner of the hotel. The next few minutes were busy with the passing of the bowls of potatoes, beans, corn, and a platter of pork chops, along with fresh hot cornbread. Except for the meal at Steiner's house, it was a great deal more food than he had been accustomed to eating since leaving the Triple G almost 3 months ago. It surpassed anything offered at the occasional diner he had happened upon on his journey to find his grandfather. Pearlie cautioned himself at once to control his urge to dive right in, lest they think him uncivilized. Resisting the desire to pick up the pork chop with his fingers and gnaw the meat away, he tried to cut it away using the knife and fork like the ladies did. Then Mrs. Bowman suggested, "Tell us about your family in Texas." "Not much to tell," he said. "My pa just died, but my ma's alive, and my sister and 2 brothers live on the ranch." He nodded toward Martha. "I've got a sister-in-law named Martha. She's my brother John's wife. My older brother Reuben's wife is named Lou Ann." "But you're not married?" Lucille said.
"No, ma'am."
Martha was the first to notice his discomfort. "I think Pearlie would like to enjoy this fine supper Grace has prepared for us," she announced. "Let's dig in and eat before we let it get cold." "Martha's right," her mother said. "Let's let the man eat." She had found out what she wanted to know, anyway. They had finished the meal and the apple pie when John Bowman started talking about his plans for Hat Creek Ranch and the opportunities that would surely be available there for any enterprising young man. Pearly suddenly felt a chill down his spine when he recalled a similar pitch about Fort Collins, Colorado. He immediately glanced at Martha, but could see no resemblance to 13-year-old Ethel Steiner. He could not guess Martha's age, but knew it was considerably older than 13. He told himself that he was in a panic over nothing. Martha Bowman was a handsome young woman. She would have no problem finding a husband, unlike poor, homely Ethel. So he put the notion out of his head. When he took another glance at Martha, her look of boredom told him he might as well. She surprised him, however, when she interrupted her father. "You're probably boring Pearly to death, talking about Hat Creek," Martha said. "Pearly, why don't you pick up your coffee and we'll go out onto the porch where it's cool, so Grace and her girl can clean off the table. She's too polite to tell us to get out of the dining room, so she can get through sometime tonight." "Of course, you're right," her mother said. "You two young folks go out and enjoy the porch. It's time we old folks went upstairs." It was obvious by his expression that her husband was not finished with his plans for the future of Hat Creek, but he managed a gracious smile and a warm good night. Pearly thanked them for their hospitality, then followed Martha to the porch, coffee cup in hand. She led him to one side and a pair of rocking chairs, laughing at his efforts to sit down without spilling his coffee. They talked about the weather and the summer season for a few minutes, before Martha asked, "Is there a girl waiting for you back in Texas, Pearly?" The question surprised him, but he could read nothing in her face but idle curiosity. "No, no girl," he answered. "There was one I thought I was interested in, but it turned out I wasn't. I reckon right now I ain't got time to think about a girl." He told her about his feelings of responsibility for finding his grandfather, to fulfill a task that his mother thought important. "Do you think it's important?" Martha asked. "'Cause if you don't, you sure have ridden a long way from Texas looking for a grandfather you've never seen before." "Oh, yes, ma'am," Burley was quick to reply. "I surely do think it's important. My father wanted to bring his father back into the Gates family, and I aim to find my grandpa to tell him that." She studied his face while he spoke of his father and the Triple G Ranch in Texas, and decided that the shy, innocent man was a disarming facade for a much deeper man within. "There's more to Pearly Gates than meets the eye," she told herself, "and I'm sure he's not even aware of it himself. Maybe it's because of that silly name he's wearing." "I expect I'd best turn in now," Pearly said, when darkness began to descend upon the Hat Creek Valley. "I'll have to be on my way in the morning. I've really enjoyed talking with you, but I don't want to overstay my welcome. I'll take my cup back to the kitchen." "Give it to me. I'll take it back for you," she said. "Thank you, ma'am," he said, and handed her the cup. "When are you going to stop calling me ma'am?" "Right now, I expect," she laughed. "Good. I was beginning to think I must look like an old lady." "No, ma'am," he said, before he caught himself. "I mean, no, Martha. You don't look like an old lady. Not by a lot." Feeling the ice was broken now, he ventured to ask, "How come you ain't married? Are all the men around this place blind or just plain stupid?" "Now you're starting to ask the questions that my father asks," she replied with a laugh. "The truth is, the right man hasn't come along yet, and I'll die an old maid before I marry the wrong one." She got up from her chair. Feeling that to be a signal that the visit was over, he jumped up too. "I enjoyed meeting you, Martha, and I hope the right man comes along pretty soon." "I'm in no hurry," she said. "I enjoyed meeting you too, Pearly. I hope we'll see you again when you're back this way, and good luck with your search for your grandfather." "Thank you, ma'am," he said, moving quickly to hold the door for her. He was baffled by the little impatient smile she gave him, unaware that he had called her ma'am again. Eager to try out the hotel bed, he went to the outhouse, then went straight to his room. Never one to have trouble going to sleep, he lay awake for what seemed a long time, thinking about his conversation with Martha Bowman. "Some young fellow will be lucky to throw a rope on that little lady," he thought, before drifting off. Chapter 14. The hotel bed proved to be a comfortable one. In his small room on the first floor, he could hear the sounds of breakfast preparations in the kitchen, and he was immediately gripped by near panic when he saw the time. He had not planned to sleep so late, and he nearly fell on his face in an effort to get into his trousers and boots. Sleeping late was akin to pure laziness, in his opinion, and he was anxious lest someone catch him abed at this late hour. With that in mind, he was intent upon getting his clothes on, grabbing his rifle and his saddlebags, and vacating the room before anyone saw him. He should have already been to the stable to pick up his horses and take them to Baskin's blacksmith shop. "Baskin is probably wondering where the hell I am," he thought, as he slowly turned the doorknob and eased the door open a crack. Peeking through the opening, he could see down the hall, and he was immediately relieved to see it empty. So he pushed the door open and stepped out into the hallway, being extra careful not to let his rifle bump on the door jamb. He wasn't aware of her presence until he closed the door and turned to go out the washroom door. "Good morning, Pearlie," she greeted him sweetly. Startled, he almost dropped his rifle as he blurted, "Martha!" before he could catch himself. "I didn't mean to startle you," she quickly apologized. Fully aware that she had caught him by surprise and he was obviously embarrassed to have been caught, she graced him with a wide smile. "Did you sleep all right?" "Well, reckon I did," he answered, "seeing as how I slept half the morning away." In the warmth of her smile, he could see that she was not judging him, and he realized that he was being silly by letting himself get so worked up over his sense of pride. "I was wondering why Papa stuck you in that room with a hard mattress on that old bed. When you told me what room you were in, I was afraid you wouldn't sleep at all." "It sure beats sleeping on the ground like I've been doing for a couple of months. So, like I said, I slept so good I almost didn't wake up till supper time." He grinned sheepishly. "That's what Papa said when I complained about that room," she said. "You probably needed a good night's sleep." She made a pretty little frown and teased, "You weren't trying to sneak out without saying goodbye, were you?" He couldn't believe how nice she was, but he still felt like a clod in her presence. "No, ma'am," he said, even though that had been his intention. "I just wanted to get out of the room in case you needed it for a paying customer. And I needed to take my horses over to Mr. Baskin's first thing. But I guess I just slept through first thing, didn't I?" She laughed again. "There's not but a couple people staying in the hotel right now, so you shouldn't worry about that." "Since you're not going to be able to start out before daylight now," she teased, "why don't you wait until you've had breakfast?" When he seemed short of an answer, she pressed, "Are you in such a big hurry to get to Deadwood that you can't wait until after you've had a good breakfast?" "I don't know," he answered after a few moments' hesitation and coming up with no real reason to hurry. "I reckon it doesn't really make a whole lot of difference how soon I get there, if we're talking about a day or two." "Good. Then why don't you do this? Go down to the stable and take your horses to Mr. Baskin, and he can shoe them while you're having breakfast back here." "I would enjoy one more meal at your table," he said, grinning. "That's just what I'll do." She walked with him to the front door before turning around to head for the kitchen to tell Grace that Pearlie would be back for breakfast, and she wanted to make sure he got one that he would remember. When Pearlie pulled up to the blacksmith shop, Ralph Baskin was working on a wagon wheel rim, but he put it aside when he saw Pearlie. "I thought maybe you'd changed your mind," Baskin said. "Nope," Pearlie said. I meant to get here earlier, but I got tied up with some things at the hotel. I got to thinking about that loose shoe on the sorrel. I know you offered to fix it for me for nothing, and I appreciate that. But while you're at it, I think you might as well check the bay's shoes, too. He ought to be due before long, so you might as well do the job now. Of course, I'd pay you for that job. What do you say? Can you do that this morning?
Sure, Baskin replied, glad to get the business. It might take me a couple of hours, though.
That'll be fine, Burley said. I ain't had my breakfast, so I'll go do that while you're working on my horses.
He started walking back to the hotel, having a little talk with himself on the way, afraid that he might be letting a pretty girl get in the way of finding his grandfather. He didn't presume that Martha had any interest in him, other than just being hospitable because she thought he saved her father's life. She was just being friendly, and he could always use a new friend. He told himself that it was all right to enjoy a friendly conversation with a young lady. His thoughts flew to Lucy Tate back in the Paris diner, and the way her conversation was always flirty, causing his imagination to lead him to wrong conclusions. Martha was more like Becky Morris, friendly but not flirty. He tried to summon an image of Becky, but kept coming up with one that looked like Martha. When he walked into the dining room, he headed for the long table in the center, but was intercepted by Martha and led to the same small table as the night before.
"I'll be right back with some coffee," she said, "and Grace will have your breakfast ready in a couple of minutes."
When she returned, she was holding two cups, and she sat down at the table with him, much to his delight.
"Are your folks coming down to eat?" Burley asked.
"Why?" she responded. "Are you ready for another speech from Papa about how big the Hat Creek Ranch is going to be?" Before he could answer, she said, "Papa's already at work in his office. He eats when the kitchen opens, and Mama won't eat anything till noon. So you're stuck with me for company." That suited Pearlie just fine. The breakfast was as good as Martha told him it would be, and the conversation was light and enjoyable. It might have gone on longer than it did, but it was Martha who was the first to suggest it was time to get on with the day.
"I know you're anxious to get started," she said, "but I've enjoyed getting to know you, Pearlie Gates. I hope you'll come back to see us sometime, and I hope you find your grandpa soon." She got up and extended her hand. He jumped up and shook her hand. "Thank you for the visit. I feel like I made a friend."
"Why, of course you have," she said.
Unable to think of anything else to say, he blurted, "Who do I pay for my breakfast?"
"Pshaw," she replied in mock irritation. "You're my guest, for goodness sakes."
"Thank you, Martha. I mean, ma'am," he said, grinning. She answered with a grin of her own.
"You take care of yourself, Pearlie Gates," she said, then watched him until he went out the door. He had been right when he said he had made a friend. She couldn't help thinking that she might have been inclined to become more than a friend, but Pearlie Gates was one of a kind. He struck her as incredibly innocent and, consequently, vulnerable to blundering into dangerous situations, just as he had there in Hat Creek, when Murdoch drew on her father. Next time, he might not be so lucky. "And I don't look good in a black dress and veil."
Close enough now to feel the spirit of the mysterious mountains the Indians called Paha Sapa, Burley was impatient to ride up into the dark pine-covered hillsides before him. He imagined that his grandfather must have felt much the same attraction when he first approached the Black Hills. It would have to wait until morning, however, because his horses were tired after a long day on the rugged trail, and the wide stream he was about to cross might offer the best choice to make his camp. Looking left and right, Pearlie decided to follow it upstream, since there appeared to be a heavier covering of trees farther up the slope. He had been cautioned by Ralph Baskin to be aware of the outlaws that preyed on those who traveled the Cheyenne to Deadwood Road, so with that in mind, he always tried to make his camp inconspicuous. After following the stream for what he figured to be a quarter of a mile, he decided that he should have gone downstream, but then up ahead he saw the clearing. Probably caused by a fire many years ago, the results of which left an open area of about an acre now covered by thick grass. It offered an ideal place to make camp. He pulled his saddle and packs from his two horses and left the animals free to drink and graze while he gathered sticks and limbs to build a fire. When he had enough wood, he took his little coffee pot to the edge of the stream to fill it with the cold, clear water. He had failed to notice until he lifted the pot from the water and glanced upstream that there were remains of an old sluice box a couple dozen yards farther up. Curious, he set his pot down and walked up to the bank to take a look at it. The only part of the sluice box left was a section that appeared to have been fashioned from a wagon box. Wonder if they found any pay dirt. He looked around, trying to imagine a couple of miners hovering over their pans, searching for their fortunes. Leaving the bank, he found the remains of the prospector's camp and decided they had picked a better spot than he had. They were obviously camped there for a while and had set up a tent or a large canvas, judging by the marks left in the ground. And there was a small fire pit made of rocks taken from the creek. Ready made, he thought, and went back to move his saddle and packs to the new location. Then he returned to pick up the firewood he had gathered and brought it back as well. Better protection, too, he decided, because of a section of the bank that rose about 4 feet behind the fire pit. It would make a good rampart in case of an Indian attack. From the looks of the camp, it had been abandoned for a long time. The prospectors who panned for gold here might have been run off or killed by Oglala Sioux. It wasn't that long ago that all this mountain range belonged to the Sioux. Nowadays, however, there was more danger from outlaws. Once his fire was going, he set his coffee pot on a couple of crossed limbs to boil and fashioned a spit to roast some of his venison. When it was done, he poured himself a cup of coffee and sat on the edge of the embankment to eat his supper. He had not finished his first cup when he heard Buck whinny. Long accustomed to paying attention to Buck's communications, Burley became at once alert. When the sorrel nickered as well and Buck snorted, it was enough to cause him to slowly put his cup down and pick up his rifle, being careful not to move too suddenly. He had a feeling that he had company, and if he did, he didn't want to let on that he was aware of it. Once he had his rifle in hand, he slid down behind the raised portion of the bank and scanned the trees in front of him, searching for some sign of movement. In a few minutes, he heard the source of Buck's concern.
"I ain't looking to cause you no trouble," a voice called out.
Burley quickly scanned the line of trees, but could not determine where the voice came from.
"You ain't got no call to be worried about me," it came again.
The voice sounded almost childlike, or maybe it came from a woman, Pearlie wasn't sure.
"If I ain't got nothing to worry about, how come you're hiding?" "'Cause you might shoot me if I come out."
"What would I do that for?" Pearlie called back.
"'Cause you might be one of them friends of Mott Mason."
"I don't know anybody named Mott Mason." "What are you doing out here in the mountains?"
"Hiding from Mott Mason."
"I reckon I should have figured that out," Pearlie thought. "I've got a feeling I'm fixing to step in another cow pie."
"Are you hungry?" he asked,
thinking that might be what instigated this discussion with the pine trees.
"Yes, sir. I sure am. I could smell that coffee cooking way back up the hill, and I ain't had nothing to eat but a frog I caught in the stream yesterday."
There was a pause of a few seconds, then,
"What's that you're cooking on the fire?"
"That's deer meat," Pearlie answered, "and I've got a gracious plenty of it." He waited, but there was no reply from the pines.
"You're gonna have to come on out of your hiding place if you want any. I ain't gonna throw good venison into the bushes. So what are you gonna do?"
The pause continued. But finally there came the question,
"Are you gonna shoot me if I come out?"
"Not if you behave yourself. I don't generally shoot women and children if I can help it."
He was convinced by this time that the voice belonged to one or the other. "Why me?" he had to ask himself. It seemed that God arranged for every woman in trouble to cross his path, and in places where most people would meet no one. It was inconceivable to think he might be facing another lost soul. He put his rifle aside, however, went to his packs, found his extra coffee cup, and held it up for her to see.
"I've got an extra cup and plenty of coffee."
That proved to be more than she could resist, and after a minute or two she stepped out of a pine thicket, then walked slowly toward him, with both hands up in the air.
"A woman," he thought, then changed his mind.
It was a girl, but it was hard to tell how old, for she looked to be in pretty rough shape.
"You can put your hands down," he said. "You ain't under arrest." He poured her a cup full and held it out to her. He couldn't help thinking it was like trying to get a wild dog to take food out of his hand. She reached out very cautiously, as if expecting him to jerk it away. When it began to look like she was never going to take the cup, he set it on the ground and backed away from it. Again, like a wild animal, she quickly reached down to grab the cup, spilling some of it before she took a step back and started sipping the hot coffee.
"Here," he said, and held the improvised spit out to her, and she quickly pulled a strip of roasted venison from it.
"Slow down, or you're gonna choke on it," he cautioned, but she continued to eat as fast as she could.
"How long has it been since you've had anything to eat, besides frogs?"
She shook her head while still chewing feverishly.
"I don't know," she managed. "About a week, I reckon."
"Well, take it easy. It ain't going anywhere," he said.
"And you can stop being scared. I ain't gonna hurt you."
He let her eat in peace for a while, until she eventually seemed to calm down, before he asked her more questions.
"Where'd you come from?"
"Omaha," she answered.
"Omaha?" he responded with surprise.
"What, on a wagon train or something?"
When she seemed confused, he realized why.
"I don't mean where were you born. I mean just now, back up that hill. Have you got a camp up above here? Is there anybody else up there?"
"No. Ain't nobody but me. And I ain't got no camp."
Pearlie was just before losing all his patience with the young girl. Finally he threw his hands up in frustration.
"Well, what in the hell are you doing here?"
"I told you. Hiding from Mott Mason," she said.
"Who's Mott Mason?" Pearlie asked, then stopped her before she could answer.
"Wait. What's your name?"
He wanted to know if her name was also Mason, and he might be stepping into a family squabble.
"Lena Rooney," she answered, hesitated, then asked,
"What's yours?"
"Pearlie Gates."
She gave him a suspicious look, thinking he was japing her.
"Pearlie Gates?"
Then she realized he was serious.
"Damn, you've got a crazier name than me," she declared. "Why'd they name you Pearlie Gates?"
"My pa's family name is Gates. I've got two brothers and a sister, so they named me Pearlie so folks could tell which Gates I was."
He didn't want to go into the whole story about his grandfather at this point. First, he wanted to find out who Lena Rooney was and how he happened to be so lucky as to have her cross his trail. He couldn't help thinking about Ethel Steiner and the trouble she had caused him. Lena Rooney seemed about the same age, and she was evidently running wild in these mountains. What was he to do with her?
"Who's Mott Mason?" he asked again.
Instead of answering his question, she asked, "Is deer meat and coffee all you've got to eat?"
"It's all I've got to eat tonight," he replied. "I didn't plan on having a guest for supper, or I'd have fixed some beans and pan biscuits."
He couldn't resist a bit of sarcasm.
"I'm traveling to Deadwood. All I wanted was something to keep the sides of my stomach from rubbing together."
"Oh, I ain't complaining," she hastened to say. "I was just wondering, that's all. You say you're going to Deadwood? Can I go with you? I'm handy as can be. I can cook for you and do chores."
"Cow pie," he blurted before he thought to stop it.
"What?"
she asked, not sure she had heard him correctly.
"Nothing," he replied.
"I don't know if you can go with me or not, at least till I find out a lot more about how you happen to be running around out here in the woods. Besides, you don't know anything about me. You might not want to travel with me at all."
"It'd be better than traveling with Mott Mason," she said. "I can guarantee you that."
His patience left him.
"Damn it, Lena Rooney! Who is Mott Mason, and why are you hiding from him?"
"He's a mean son of a bitch," she replied.
Then finally went on to tell Pearlie her story.
"My daddy sold me to Mott Mason for a milk cow and $35. I've got two brothers, but Mott didn't want no boys, and Daddy was glad to get rid of me anyway. He said he could get milk and butter from a cow, and I didn't give him anything but an extra mouth to feed."
"Why did this Mason fellow want to buy you?" Pearlie asked. "Did he take you for a wife?"
"Hell no," Lena protested. "He was wanting to make a whore out of me. He already had two women riding with him. They're older than me and had experience whoring, and he was on his way to Custer City. He was fixing to teach me how to please men. I told him I didn't want to please no men. He said I didn't have no choice, that I was his property, bought and paid for, and I'd do what he told me to. I told him in a pig's eye I would. So he whooped me good with his belt, and said if I ever tried to run away, he'd track me down and beat me to death. I promised I wouldn't try to run, but I was just waiting for the right chance. And that came along when that horse of his couldn't pull the wagon up a steep trail that was supposed to lead to the wagon road to Custer City. He made us all get out of the wagon and get behind it and push. So I pushed as hard as I could, until my feet went out from under me on some loose gravel, and I landed right on my face."
She made a pouty face for him then.
"Do you think they'd have stopped and helped me up?"
"Well, you'd be wrong.
They just left me a-laying there, my dress tore and blood running out of my nose, and they kept going."
"Is that when you ran off?" Pearlie asked.
"I figured I wouldn't likely get a better chance, with old Mott up ahead leading the horse. So I just rolled over to the side of the trail and gave him about 5 minutes to miss me. He was too busy trying to get the horse up that trail, and Belle and Lucy didn't give a damn if I was all right or not. So I got up and took off across the side of the mountain."
"How long ago was that?" Pearlie wanted to know.
She paused to recall. "I swear, I ain't sure. I ran around that mountain till almost dark. Then I found me a place to hide in a gully. I fell asleep after a while, and when I woke up it was daylight, so I took off again, between that mountain and another, trying to head north. That night I piled up a bunch of leaves and slept under them. I know I walked 2 more days before I started up this stream."
Pearlie handed her another strip of venison when it was done, which she took eagerly, tearing into it like a hungry wolf. A few minutes before, she had said she hadn't eaten in a week, causing him to be a little skeptical, since she didn't appear to be as weak as she would have been if her story was true. He asked, "Did you really eat a frog?" She screwed her face up like she had eaten a sour pickle.
A little bit of one. I was so hungry I thought I could eat the whole thing. But his legs were still kicking when I tried to chew him up, and I spit him out.
What the hell am I going to do with her? This was the question Pearlie now asked himself. You said you were trying to head north. Where were you thinking about going?
Deadwood, she answered.
And when he asked why, she said,
'Cause Mott Mason is going to Custer City.
And Deadwood is where most people are heading now. So I figure I've got a chance to find myself something I can do there to survive. Washing dishes, cleaning up, washing clothes, something.' She could read it in his face that he was trying to decide what to do with her. After a long moment when he said nothing, she pressed.
"That's the reason I want to go to Deadwood with you. I don't know how to get there by myself, and I won't cause you no trouble. Like I said, I'll do for you and help you out all I can. And when we get to Deadwood, I'll just say thank you and goodbye. All right?"
She studied his face intently, hoping that when she said she would do for him, he wouldn't take that to mean the same thing Mott Mason expected of her. The thought of Mott caused a feeling of nausea momentarily. At least with Pearlie, it would not be as disgusting.
"So what do you say, Pearlie? Can I go with you?"
"I reckon," he answered right away. He had no choice. He couldn't leave her to find her own way. She had no means to even stay alive unless he took care of her. "I ought to tell you, though, I've never been to Deadwood, so I'm just following the stagecoach road, and it passes through Custer City before it goes to Deadwood. So I reckon we'll have to go around Custer, if that's where this fellow Mason is heading." He took a long look at her and shook his head. "Too bad you didn't run off with some more clothes with you. That dress looks like it's just holding together. I've got a coat in my packs. You can put that on, and I've got an extra blanket I figured I might need if I was still here when cold weather hits. We can make you up a bedroll with that." She was suddenly all smiles.
"I won't be no trouble, Pearlie. You won't be sorry."
"I already am," he thought, wondering how he happened to attract one stray after another, starting with Liz and Stella, then Ethel Steiner, now Lena Rooney. He wasn't sure how far he was from Custer City. He had told her he would ride around it, but he didn't want to do that. It might be the very place he could strike his grandpa's trail. "I reckon I'll have to hide her someplace while I go into town," he told himself. "Well, let's get you a bed fixed up," he said, and went to his packs to find the extra blanket. "If you want to help, you can rinse out the coffee pot and cups." Without waiting for him to suggest it, she busied herself collecting firewood to keep the fire going while he went to check on his horses. He hobbled the sorrel's front legs, then spent some time checking Buck to see how the new shoes were working out.
"What's his name?" Lena asked, when she walked up to Pearlie and the bay gelding.
"His name's Buck," Pearlie answered. She gave that a moment's thought, then asked,
"What's the other one's name?"
"Pack horse," Pearlie answered with a chuckle, since the sorrel didn't have a name. He had cut him out of the Ramuda at Ogallala, never thinking about naming him. "You can think up a name for him while we're riding to Deadwood."
"I'll think on it," she said.
"Well, I'm turning in," Pearlie announced. "You need some help with that blanket?"
"Nope. I'm just going to roll up in it."
That's just what she did, while Pearlie walked downstream to find a place to take care of business in private. Still a little concerned about her own safety, even as nice as Pearlie seemed, she lay there, stone still and stiff as a board, awaiting his return. If he had any ideas about crawling into that blanket with her, now was the time. And she listened as he approached from the creek bank. She could hear his footsteps as he walked through the low bushes under the pines. Then, after what seemed a short period with no sound at all, She turned her head slowly in his direction. He was settled in his bedroll, and by all appearances, already on his way to sleep.
"Thank you, Lord," she said in a silent prayer of gratitude. "You sent me a decent man."
She turned over on her side and went to sleep. She awoke the following morning to the aroma of coffee bubbling in the pot. After a moment of confusion, while she remembered where she was, she suddenly sat straight up.
"Oh, shit!" she exclaimed. "I should have been up before now."
"What for?" Pearlie asked.
"To cook our breakfast," she said. "I should have been up before you."
"I think you needed the sleep. You looked like you hadn't had any decent sleep for a while, so I didn't think you'd mind if I went ahead and started it."
"Well, I'll take over," she declared, scrambling out of the blanket. "Just give me a minute to visit those bushes over near the clearing. I'll be right back."
She took off without waiting for his reply.
"Take your time. Ain't no hurry," he said, even though she was already out of earshot. "I reckon I ought to be used to traveling with women by now."
He turned his attention back to the bacon in the frying pan. Squatting in a thick row of serviceberry bushes close to the grassy clearing and a considerable distance from the fire, Lena was busy getting rid of some of the coffee she had consumed the night before. About to thank her lucky stars for having been sent a good Samaritan in her time of need, she froze when she heard the bushes parting behind her. At once frightened and angry at the same time, she turned to defend herself, only to find the big bay gelding gazing at her in idle curiosity. Unable to contain it, she let out a whoop and laughed at her immediate presumption. Finishing up her business, she grasped the nosy horse's bridle and stroked its neck and face. Then, for the hell of it, she jumped up on his back and, taking the reins, turned him toward the campfire and rode back to pull up before a startled Pearlie. Still sitting astride the big horse, Lena was puzzled by the look of amazement on Pearlie's face.
"What is it?" she asked.
"Nothing," he answered, not sure himself. Unable to resist finding out for certain, he had to ask. "You done much riding before?"
"I used to ride my pa's horses all the time when he had the farm," she said.
"How about riding Buck down there and lead the sorrel back up here near the fire, so I can saddle him?"
"All right," she said, and wheeled Buck around.
In a few minutes she returned, leading the packhorse. When she saw the same strange expression on Pearlie's face, she asked,
"Is everything all right? Did I do something wrong?"
"Nope," he answered, as she slid off the horse's back.
"It's just that you're the first person I've ever seen come off a buck of their own accord. Buck don't let anybody ride him but me."
He paused and scratched his head. "And now, I reckon, you." His declaration pleased her, and she immediately took over the cooking.
"Have you got any flour?"
"In the packs," he replied, pointing to one, still puzzling over the fact that Buck didn't buck her off.
"You go saddle up, and I'll see what you've got to cook with. We'll have us a good breakfast before we get started to Deadwood."
He did as she instructed, not realizing that she had taken charge of things in short order. He was yet to learn that it was her nature to tend to do things as she thought they should be done. One thing he found out right away, however, was her ability to cook, which almost made him glad she had crossed his path. This, even though he had no idea what he would do with her when they reached Deadwood. It was not until they had finished eating and Lena had washed the cups and pan that she asked why he was going to Deadwood. So he told her about his grandfather, whose name he shared, and his quest to find the old man. She listened with rapt attention.
"So you ain't going to Deadwood looking to hunt gold like everybody else?" she asked when he had finished. "And your grandpa don't even know about you?"
"That's right," Pearlie answered. She was impressed. I reckon you're pretty proud to be wearing your grandpa's name, then.
Well, he hesitated, I reckon I ain't ashamed of it. But sometimes it's caused me a little trouble.
Chapter 15. With Lena riding behind him, holding the pack horse's lead rope, Pearlie guided Buck back down the stream and returned to the Cheyenne-Deadwood stage road. They would travel about 15 miles, following the sometimes treacherous road, before Pearlie decided the horses were working too hard on the mountain trail. When they came to a park-like campground that looked to be a change-up station for the stage line, he let the horses rest. There was grass on the hillside and a strong creek for water. A man who had been standing on the porch of the large log house watching them approach stepped down to meet them.
"Good day to you," he said, as he continued to study Pearlie and the young girl behind him.
"Howdy," Pearlie replied. "Mind if we water our horses out of your creek there and let them rest a while?"
"Don't mind at all," the man said. "We don't own the creek anyway. And if you want to graze your horses, you can turn them out in my pasture there."
He talked to Pearlie, but he continued to study the bedraggled-looking girl behind him.
"How about you and your lady friend there? My missus can cook you up some dinner for 25 cents apiece."
"I was figuring on cooking my own dinner," Pearlie said, and turned to give Lena a look. "But maybe it'd be a nice thing to treat you to a good hot dinner. What do you say, Lena?"
"That'd be real nice," Lena replied. "As long as you ain't expecting me to come up with a quarter."
"I reckon we'll buy some dinner, then," Pearlie said to the man.
"Good," he said. "My name's John Potter. I'll tell my wife to fix up a couple of plates. Just come right on in the house after you take care of your horses. The young lady can come on in while you're doing that."
"Much obliged," Pearlie said while Lena climbed down. Then he rode Buck over by the creek to leave him and the pack horse to drink. Once inside the house, Potter turned at once to face Lena.
"Are you all right, young lady?"
Surprised by the question, Lena hesitated, thinking the man might be touched in the head. Then she remembered that she must look a sight, and she couldn't help laughing.
"I will be after I eat, if your wife can cook halfway decent."
She realized that Potter might be thinking Pearlie had abducted her and treated her badly.
"I fell out of a wagon back yonder in the mountains, and if Pearlie hadn't come along, I'd still be wandering around in the woods."
Potter looked relieved. He had summoned his courage to step in and do the right thing, if the situation was, in fact, what it first appeared to be. He was now happy to take Lena's word that she was not being abused.
"Come on in the kitchen," he said, then called his wife.
"Sarah, we've got two travelers that want to buy some dinner."
When they walked into the kitchen, Sarah was standing there waiting. Like her husband, her initial reaction to Lena was to gasp in alarm.
"Child," she cried, "what happened to you?"
Lena told them of her sale to the cruel Mott Mason and of her accident while pushing his wagon up a steep trail.
"You poor child," Sarah Potter wailed.
"Then who is the man who brought you here?"
"Like I told your husband," Lena said. "He found me after I'd been wandering around lost. He said he'd take me to Deadwood."
She hung her head to affect a convincing appearance of disgrace.
"I know I look a sight, but I ain't got no clothes. Mott Mason rode off with every stitch I had."
Sarah shook her head, overcome with compassion for the unfortunate young girl.
"Well, thank the Lord for guiding you to us. I can clean you up a little, and I'm sure I've got an old dress that would at least give you something better than that ragged one you're wearing."
"That's mighty kind of you, Mrs. Potter, but I know Pearlie's in a hurry to get to Deadwood. He's trying to find his old grandpa, and I wouldn't want to hold him up. He could have left me in the mountains like Mott Mason did, but he said he'd take me to Deadwood, so I don't want to make no fuss."
"Well, he can just wait till we take care of you," the resolute woman said. "You can't go a step farther till we fix you up, and that'll start with a good meal. You're too late to eat with the hired hands.
but I can rustle up some ham and eggs in a jiffy. Hands on hips, she turned to face the door when she heard Pearlie walking across the porch. Somewhat startled,